Okay. Oh my God, we're back from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. This is People Pleaser, and we're doing it. I think this is the first episode that I've put out of the podcast in like 3 weeks. I was out of town for a little bit, and also I've just been, I don't know, dude, I've been tired this year. This year makes me tired. This whole year being a politically active person on the internet and being a political commentator has just made me so tired. Oh man, it's all the infighting, you know? I think I'm used to having to fight. Like I spent 2020 through 2022, like those first few years of the pandemic, arguing with people about like whether or not masks actually help people stay safe from airborne viruses and like whether or not vaccines are effective or not. And that was like, I don't know, like that's like a little easier to like manage when you're just like, I just flat out disagree with you. This is a global situation and the global death rate is on the rise. And you just like are flat out ignoring the advice of the global majority of medical professionals and medical scientists, in favor of like conspiratorial QAnon shit. But this year's been so, utterly exhausting because the people that I've been fighting with the most are just people who I am ideologically aligned with. I have the same values and the same goals and the same beliefs as my friends on the far left. I consider myself a leftist, but many of my leftist friends on the internet have, you know, decided that I'm the worst person in the world and that I am indistinguishable from, you know, far right, authoritarian, fascist conservatives because we disagree on political strategy. And it's been really, really exhausting, to say the least. And it makes it hard for me to like put out content at the same clip that I used to, because I just am like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to have productive discourse with people who are this ideologically rigid. And also like, it's been really kind of upsetting to see people who I am ideologically aligned with, you know, use the same rhetorical argumentative tactics that people on the far right use. They do a lot of goalpost moving. Like they'll say stuff like, you're a piece of shit because you haven't been outspoken on the genocide in Gaza. And I'm like, actually, there's so many hours of footage of me being publicly outspoken since October. Check the links in my bio. I've been fundraising for families in Gaza since October. I've been very outspoken about the genocide in Gaza and very, very clear that my stance is that it is a genocide, that it is a humanitarian crisis, that it is something that demands our attention and our empathy and our compassion, and that it is like the serious issue of our time. I've been very, very clear about that from the start. And instead of going, oh, my bad, sorry, I hadn't seen any of those videos, they just like move the goalpost and they're like, well, you're still a piece of shit because of blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, cool. Great. So what's the point of even trying to have productive discourse with you? Like you've decided that I'm bad and nothing I can say will change your mind about me being bad. And I'm used to that from people on the far right. But it's been kind of like heartbreaking and just like exhausting to try to do that with my friends, and people that I'm used to like standing in solidarity with and like trying to pull in the same direction as. Okay, today I'm back with the podcast. I'm back because obviously a week after the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, the DNC, they haven't spoken up yet, but the Biden-Harris administration dropped an earth-shattering bombshell on the world and announced that President Biden will not be running for president in the November election, will not be seeking a second term, and has endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, to pave the way for her to make a presidential run. The DNC, of course, has not picked its official nominee, but like the writing's on the wall at this point. Everybody's backing her. AOC's backing her. Gavin Newsom is backing her. Like the names just keep rolling in of people who are Ilhan Omar. You know, more and more and more people are announcing their endorsement of Kamala Harris as the next president of the United States. And, you know, all in all, for me as a person who has just been utterly dreading November, I'm trying to allow myself to just let this be a little bit of good news. You know, it's the people who are, you know, staunchly digging their heels in on voting AIPAC out are not going to budge on this. There is going to be a certain level of ideological rigidity amongst the voters on the left, and this is not going to move the needle for them, and that's all right. But I do think that there is a not insignificant faction of voters on the left who have just sort of been dreading having to make a choice between, like, obviously you don't want to, you're not going to vote for Donald Trump. That's not an option. But, like, having to vote for this, like, old man who can barely stand and walk, who keeps trying to kiss women who aren't his wife because he thinks that they're his wife. Like, it's just not been sitting well with people. And no one's felt excited, or there hasn't been a lot of fervor or energy behind this presidential race from voters on the left, even people who are going to hold their nose and voting for Joe Biden. And today there is, like, this outcry of ecstasy and energy on the internet that I haven't seen in years and years and years from the voting bloc on the left. And so that is exciting to see. It's exciting to see a candidate that people can feel inspired about. And, you know, I mean, when you really break down the presidency and the executive branch of power in America, a lot of what it is, for most people, because most people are not very politically savvy and they're not actually, like, going out of their way to educate themselves on the finer details of what different candidates are proposing and what they're actually accomplishing in office. For a lot of people, what a candidate represents, especially a candidate for the office of president, is just sort of like an aesthetic representation of the soul of the country. It's just sort of a symbolic, like, here's who we want to be. Here's sort of the mascot of our national identity. And that's sort of, in its best form, what the Obama administration was. It was a symbol to the rest of the world that America is trying to take steps in the right direction and trying to reckon with its past and reckon with its incredibly white supremacist and racist history, and say we're trying to do something about that. It's a symbolic, aesthetic thing. And to respond to that by swinging into the most, like, grossly far-right, extreme authoritarian, disgusting con artist, felon version of, like, a gross old rich white guy, to, like, swing back to that was so disheartening, obviously, in 2016. And it was so gross and so upsetting and so stomach churning that it got the voting coalition on the left to come together in 2020 and elect someone who nobody wanted to elect. Like, nobody was excited about electing Joe Biden, but that's how, you know, distasteful the image of, you know, just, like, having to listen to Donald Trump speak on a regular basis and having to, like, have him be relevant in the news. It was so nice for, you know, between, like, 2020 and 2022, when he sort of went away for a little bit, when you just didn't have to listen to him as regularly. And even through a lot of 2023, we still weren't having to, like, listen to him speak as regularly. But, you know, having him back, I think, has reminded us, like, oh God, that guy is such a gross, you know, Jabba the Hutt ass motherfucker. And it sucked that we couldn't have a candidate to put up against him that people could get excited about. And that we were going to have to, like, just suck it up and deal with this guy who, like, literally can't answer questions about his mental fitness in an interview. And we're just like, oh shit, this sucks. But, you know, today we get some information that it's like, okay. We get to run somebody that gets to be at least symbolically a nice vibe for where our soul is at. As, like, we get to actually go, hey, how about this? How about the first, not just the first woman as president, but a woman of color who's 20 years younger than Donald Trump, who's just so much sharper and so much better spoken and so much, you know, more experienced in the field than he is. How about that? And how about that's the candidate that we get to run against this guy? And that's just such a better option, and it just feels so much better. And you can see it, you can feel it on the internet today. It's exciting, you know? Is it everything that I would want as a leftist on my checklist? Not even close, no. But that's what we're going to talk about today. I want to talk today about the power of working as a coalition and what people on the left can accomplish when they're willing to pull in the same direction consistently as a coalition. I made a video recently where I asked the question, I said, you know, what's the strategy? Because this is at a point where I really was just feeling like, I really was just feeling like Donald Trump's going to win. Like, there's just not enough excitement behind Joe Biden as a candidate. And by not enough, I mean there's basically none. There is a totally not insignificant subset of voters on the left who are determined to make sure that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are not viable anymore. And they're not a huge amount of people, but they're enough that they could absolutely sway this. I said in that video, I said in another video about third party candidates that, like, if the election was held tomorrow, and I said this a few weeks ago, I said Joe Biden could probably pull about 65 million votes. There'd probably be about 65 million people who would turn out and vote for him, and he'd probably lose by about 7 to 8 million in the popular vote, and he'd probably lose by a slim margin in the electoral vote. But he wouldn't win if it was tomorrow. And I really believed that. I really thought this thing was kind of, the writing was on the wall. So my question was, what's the plan? What are, you know, for everybody who really wants him out, what's our plan for dealing with Project 2025 and a second Trump administration? What's our plan when Trump gets to appoint two more Supreme Court justices to the Supreme Court, and we have to deal with 40 or 50 years of a supermajority of conservatives in the Supreme Court? How do we deal with that? What's the long-term strategy of that? I get why people are upset in the short term. I get why people are dissatisfied with our country's long-standing, decades-long alliance with Israel, and I understand why people are upset about that, but what's the long-term strategy? And it can't just be burn it all to the ground, because that, I've never understood that. I've never understood how, like, the logic here is, I'm so upset about the wanton death and destruction in the Middle East. It's so disgusting to me, and it's so heartbreaking to me that I want to burn down my back. I just want to kill everyone around me. That's how mad I am. I've never really understood that. I've never understood how the answer to that, how a solution to that is a big bloody civil war or revolution here in America. I don't get how that is like a logical leap to go. The, like, war and destruction and families being decimated and neighborhoods being decimated and children being orphaned and killed is so heartbreaking to me that I want to see that happen here. I want it to happen to the people that I know. I want it to happen to my friends and my neighbors, because that's how upset I am. I get being upset. I just don't get how, you know, violence is your solution to violence. So my question was, what's the plan? What are we going to do? What's the strategy here? What's the long-term game? A lot of people who responded to me, and I got so many responses. I got like 20,000 comments on the original video. I got a couple hundred response videos. My DMs have been full for like 2 weeks. But a lot of people who responded to me said, I'm going to turn the question back around on you. What's your plan? You know, that was their sort of gotcha, was like, what's your strategy? And like, first of all, my answer to that is like, I don't fucking know. That's why I'm asking the question. I genuinely don't know. When I said I'm asking a sincere question here, I meant it. I wasn't using some kind of rhetorical device to like create some kind of gotcha. I genuinely don't know. Like, that was my thing, is I was like, I don't know what the long-term strategy of you know, far left people who are determined to spoil the election for the Democratic Party. I don't know what their long-term strategy is here. I hear words like revolution. I hear words like direct action. I hear words like community organizing and stuff like that. I hear third party. I hear ranked choice voting. I don't really take third party candidacy seriously, especially when it crops up just once every 4 years. You need to be able to be viable at the local level. You need to show that you can actually compete in the two-party system, that you can actually beat the establishment powers at the local level and actually be viable. You need to show that you actually have serious numbers. And what serious numbers mean in a presidential election is like minimally 80 million people who are talking about your campaign. And if you don't have that, if you've got 2 million people or 5 million people, then I don't take you seriously. So I'm hearing people say this stuff, but then they're flipping it around on me and going, what's your strategy? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. That's why I'm asking the question. And that's why, you know, like, when people say, what's your ideal presidential ticket? I go, I don't really like to deal in that. I don't really like to spend time dreaming about who my ideal presidential candidate is. I want to deal deal with the situation that is placed in front of me. I look at this election. The word that keeps coming up for me is triage. It's a situation where it's like, I'm not happy about the decision that has to be made. It's not exciting, but you've got to start planning for harm reduction. And that's so much of what being a voter on the left in America is all the time, is just how do I strategize in a way that reduces the most, that reduces harm the most and prevents the most possible people from experiencing hardship and harm and losses of their personal freedoms and rights. Can't tell you how many people over the last few weeks have been like, you only care because you finally stand to be in the line of fire as like a white man. And I'm like, no, it genuinely has nothing to fucking do with me. I'll probably actually be fine during a second Trump presidency as a straight white man. I am most concerned about my most marginalized friends, about the people in the most marginalized and vulnerable communities. Those are the people that I'm concerned about when I ask, what's the plan? Anyway, I do actually have a pseudo sort of answer to that question, though, actually, when people say, well, what's your plan? You know, how are you going to deal with the fact that, like, there is a valid reason why there is this subset of voters on the left who are just like, I'm never going to vote for the Democratic Party ever again. I'm so sick and tired of doing this. I totally get it. Being a voter on the left, especially the far left in America, is so difficult because you never, ever, ever get to have a candidate who actually represents you. Like, the closest any candidate comes to actually representing your values and your political goals is, like, you get, like, a candidate that's, like, 10, maybe 15% of, like, what you're looking for in a candidate. And it's so disappointing year after year to be like, how come I have to, like, be the bigger person and swallow the bullet of like voting for a person who barely represents me, when voters on the right constantly get to vote for candidates who will just tell them any, who will just totally appease all of their bigoted ideology and just say all of the bigoted extremist viewpoints that they want? How come I can't get someone who's like vowing to, you know, bring down capitalism and like take down the billionaire class and like, you know, socialize healthcare and stuff? Like, how come I can't get a candidate like that? It's very frustrating, and I get it and I understand it. The thing that people talk about a lot, the thing the voters on the left talk about a lot, is like the political Overton window in America, that everything in America is shifted heavily to the extreme right. And they're correct about this. The far authoritarian fascistic right in America has mainstream representation, has mainstream political power. It is a politically viable position in America. A candidate can be a far-right extremist, white supremacist, authoritarian, Christian theocratic, like all the words, all the bad words in America, and be viable. They can have a real shot at winning elections in America. And that's because our political Overton window is heavily shifted to the right. So when people are saying, well, what's your strategy? What are you going to do about it? What I start thinking about is like, what works for voters on the left? What actually works for us as a voting coalition? And how do we actually succeed? And it's got to be a long-term strategy in my mind, especially when I'm thinking about things that are harm reduction. I don't want to think of things in terms of like, revolution's the only answer. Everybody strap up and here we go. We're going to go into the streets and we're going to, you know, get ready to have sacrifice millions of lives for the cause, and hopefully we'll win the revolution, and we'll topple the government, and we'll get to be in charge, and we'll get to build our leftist utopia. I think that that is like massively unrealistic and also like incredibly dangerous. I think it's just like you're signing millions of people up for a war that they're not consenting to. And you're just saying like, whether you guys are ready for it or not, I'm ready. I'm so fed up that I'm ready to get in the streets and like go toe to toe with the American military. Well, a lot of us aren't. You know, a lot of disabled people aren't. A lot of children aren't. A lot of like people who have children aren't. You know, a lot of people who, just a lot of people in general are like, I'd rather not. If there's an option, if there's a strategy that allows us to avoid a long, deadly civil war, that would be great. And so that's what I want to talk about, is the power of working as a coalition. So here's the reality for voters on the left in America. We have the numbers to never lose another election if we want to. And we show this all the time. We show this about every 4 to 8 years. We show that when we vote in a uniform way as a coalition, when we're all willing to pull in the same direction, we're pretty damn hard to beat, next to impossible. There's a reason why the Republican Party has not won a popular vote in decades. And it's because they don't actually have the numbers to do that. The way that the Republican Party is surviving in the modern American political system is through, you know, underhanded political techniques like gerrymandering and doing things like, you know, creating voting districts that are heavily biased toward their candidates and stuff like that, and kind of like working better at the local and community level. But also the thing that really, really, really allows them to continue having a foothold in American politics is the woeful inconsistency of the left's vote, of the voting coalition of people on the left. We're just way too inconsistent. I had someone in my comments the other day say, you can't just keep telling people to vote harder. That can't be the strategy. You know, just every 4 years saying vote harder. People are getting fed up. And I think that that is a fundamental misunderstanding of what the long-term strategy actually is. It's not just show up and vote harder every year. It's vote consistently. And this is something that the voting coalition on the left has actually never tried. In my lifetime, we've never actually done it. So we can vote together and pull in the same direction and win elections. Our problem is doing that consistently and doing that election cycle after election cycle. I got a little visual aid here. For the people on TikTok, this is going to be backwards, but for the people on YouTube, you'll be able to see it, okay? This is our political spectrum. All right, we got the left and the right. It's spectral, right? You could call the Overton window of politics in America, you could also rename it as like the viability window, the window of who is and who isn't a viable candidate. What positions are viable? What positions have the ability to win elections in America? Unfortunately, for the last, 40 years, since basically the 80s, since Ronald Reagan, the political Overton window has been shifting increasingly to the right in America, which means that the viability window on the left starts about here, and then the entire window just goes all the way over to the political right. It's about that big. If you're just listening online, I'm talking, if you're just listening on Spotify, I'm drawing a line that's like just left of center. Like that's maybe like as far left as the viability window goes for politicians who are aligned on the left in America. And then it goes all the way to the far extreme side of the right side of the spectrum. And that's where our current window is. So how do you get the window to shift over to the left? That's sort of the question when we talk about strategy, when we talk about what's the plan. How do you get that thing to shift over? This is really hard. This is a hard sell for people who align on the far left side of this spectrum. People who are not getting candidates that are anywhere close to what they want. Candidates who are anywhere close to representing their wish list. It's a tough sell because what we're asking for is minimally 16 straight years of consistent voting as a coalition. And that's really, really hard, especially because, like I said, the majority of voters have very short memories and are not very politically invested. I was talking about third-party candidates the other day and talking about why they're not viable and saying you need minimally in America 80 million people, minimally, who are aware of who your candidate is, aware that your candidate is running for president, and are at least considering voting for your candidate. A lot of these third-party candidates, Jill Stein, RFK, Cornel West, they don't have anywhere near that many people who are aware that they're running for president. Today is day one of Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. It's the first day, and the entire world knows that she's running for president. The entire world knows what she looks like, what she sounds like, what her name is, and they know that she's running for president against Donald Trump. That's the kind of pull and relevance and brand awareness you need in order to have a viable shot in an American two-party election, in a presidential election. You need massive numbers. So you need, you know, somebody that like the larger coalition of voters is aware of. Anyway, I was talking about third-party candidacy, and somebody said, You know, it's your fault, Austin, that you're not more aware of the candidacy of people like Cornel West or Jill Stein or RFK. As a political commentator and a politically active voice on the internet, you should be doing the work to make sure you're aware of all of the things that are happening. And like, hey, fair point. The point that I'm making is the larger voting populace is not going to do that work. The point that I'm making is I did not have to seek out news of Joe Biden dropping out of the presidential race and Kamala Harris getting everybody's endorsement in order to be aware that that's what was happening. I did not need to be like diligently doing my political homework in order to get this news. It just was instantly known by everybody. Within the first hour, everyone you know was aware of this news. And that's a level of political influence and reach that no third party candidate is anywhere near at this point. And they're not going to get anywhere near that level of political reach before November. I don't say this stuff to be a bummer or a spoil sport or to be rude. I say this stuff because I strategically want to deal with what is actually real. I talk about triage because triage is the very nature of like dealing with reality. When you look at a situation where you go, there's more patients in this hospital than we have hands on deck to treat all of them. We do not have enough resources or people on call to make sure we can save every single life in this hospital today. So we need to make a difficult decision about who we think we can save and who has to die. That's not a fun decision. That's not an inspiring decision. That's not an exciting decision, but it is dealing with the reality that is placed in front of you. And if certain people want to look at that situation and go, well, I vote that nobody dies, and that's what I vote for, and they sort of do this in a way to pat themselves on the back and say, well, you can go ahead and vote for the option where some people have to die, but I refuse to do that. And it's like, cool, awesome. I like, way to go, you, for taking a moral stance. You're not living in reality. The trolley problem. We've got two options in November. We can pull the lever and run over 5 people. We can pull the lever and run over 500 people. It sucks. It's not a fun thing to have to deal with. And people are going, I want to turn the trolley into an airplane and fly over everybody. Cool. That's awesome. Hypothetically, that would be really cool. Hypothetically, in the world of infinite possibilities where we just can do anything, that'd be so cool. That'd be awesome if we could retrofit this trolley and turn it into a rocket ship. We're not going to. That's not what's going to happen. I'm not saying this because I support it or because I like it. I'm saying it because it's what's real. So anyway, where was I? Third party candidacy. I'm talking to these like people about like, they're like, well, you need to be doing your job to be more informed about everything that's going on. And I'm like, cool, I could be, sure. I could be, as a political commentator on the internet, doing more to be more aware of like what it is that Cornel West is offering, what it is that Jill Stein is offering, what it is that RFK is offering. The reason why I'm not is because I don't take them seriously as candidates. There's no point in me making sure I'm boned up on their agenda before they at least have like 40 million people who are saying in polls that they're going to vote for them. And that's not enough. 40 million is not, it's not nearly enough for me to actually be like, oh, I should actually look into what this person is talking about. So it's just in my opinion, it's a waste of time. It's like you're asking me, like, you should be reading the schematics on how we can turn the trolley into a rocket ship. You should be reading up on it. And I'm like, well, unless you can actually show me a budget of how we're going to do that, if you can actually show me that you have the donors and you have the financial backing to get this trolley turned into a rocket ship before November, if you can show me that the numbers make sense and support what you're proposing, then I'll check out these schematics and then I'll start talking about these schematics. But if you're just talking about a pie in the sky crazy idea that you have no way of actually accomplishing, what the fuck is the point? And I'm not, again, I'm not saying that to be rude. I'm saying that because, like, get real. Like, I'm so sorry that this is the way that it is, that we live in a two-party system. Again, coalitions. The reason why I'm all over the place today. There's too much. This is why, I mean, this is why it's been hard for me to make an episode lately. The reason why it's difficult to get the voting coalition on the left to vote consistently each election cycle is because we're a far more intellectually and ideologically and culturally diverse coalition than the coalition on the right. The coalition on the right is made up of primarily white, heteronormative Christian people. They're different denominations of Christian. They're, you know, different levels of full-blown white supremacists, you know, and different levels of full-blown authoritarian fascists who want all-out theocracy. They vary. There's degrees there. But in general, they are a much more homogenous voting block of people. So they vote pretty consistently. You can pretty much count election cycle in, election cycle out, on about 70 to 75 million of them pulling in the same direction for far right extremist candidates or whatever candidates the RNC is offering them up. They are a much more, they're a much easier voting block to pander to and appease. They're a much easier voting block to like inspire. There's a reason why they turn out in big numbers at rallies and why they are, you know, prone to cult-like behavior, because they're just a much more ideologically and culturally homogenized group of people. The people on the left, the voters on the left, we are just everybody else in the world. We're every other religion, we're every other culture, we're every other race, we're every other country, we're every other nationality. We are just everyone else. And because of that, we're a coalition of like 100 to 120 million people who have a lot of different ideas about how to achieve similar goals. We have similar values and similar goals. And one of the most common things that we have in common is that we like oppose the idea of far-right authoritarian theocracy. Like, that is like the thing that most of us have in common, is just that, like, in general, we all are like, I definitely don't want to live in a far-right authoritarian theocracy. And that's what my counterparts on the right half of the political spectrum seem to want. And we all kind of can agree on what we don't want and what we don't like. But then when it comes to our specific vision of what the future of the country should look like and the strategy of how to achieve that, we are so much more ideologically and strategically diverse than the right is. And it makes it really, really, really hard to sell a candidate to us or a political idea to us that is equally inspiring to all of us. What more often than not happens with the voting coalition on the left is a lot of us wind up having to vote for something that we're not super excited about and that we're not super like inspired by, but that acts as the antidote to whatever crazy shit the right is proposing. So all the way back to my proposed strategy of how to get this Overton window from all the way over here to slightly shifted to the left, and why it's going to take minimally 16 years of consistent voting from people on the left. And I don't even know if we can do this, but Kamala really presents a really amazing opportunity. What you need to do to defeat a beast like far-right extremism in America is you need to starve it. And starving it takes patience and time. You need to deprive it of the thing that, of the fuel that keeps it alive. So what has kept far-right authoritarian extremism alive as a viable political position in America this long is the fact that every 4 to 8 years, we let them have more power. We let them win elections again. And every time we do that, we let them stay alive. We let that position remain viable and remain relevant. And I mean, somebody the other day in my comments, some, you know, dug-in leftist was like, the only reason you think the way that you think is because you lack the vision to see more than 4 years in the future. And I was like, boy, the projection of that comment is crazy, because that we're literally in the situation we're in right now because of your inability to see further than 4 years into the future. Like, I bet you $1 million that this person who said this in my comments voted for Joe Biden in 2020. And when the world didn't turn into a leftist utopia in the first 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration, this person did what a lot of voters on the left consistently do. And they go, well, I'm sick of this shit. Every election cycle, the Democrats promise me that if I hold my nose and vote for them, that it'll be better, that I'll get my way. And then they never do it. And I'm so sick and tired of this shit. And we've seen this cycle play out again and again and again. We saw it in 2000 when, you know, people spoiled the election voting for Ralph Nader. And we had such a close election between Al Gore and George Bush. And like, it's so crazy to think about the chain reaction of how the world would be different if Al Gore had been president, and what that would mean for the environment, for climate change, what that would mean for the Supreme Court, what that would have meant for the 20-year war that we got into in the Middle East. It's crazy the chain reaction that happened because people, a certain faction of voters on the left in the left voting coalition, were so upset that they didn't get everything on their wish list in the 8-year Clinton administration. They were so frustrated and fed up that they were like, God, we did it. We held our nose and we went with your candidate. And look, the world has not completely changed. The Overton window has not bounced back from the Reagan administration. I'm sick of this shit. I'm sick of giving the Democrats my vote when they didn't earn it. I'm voting for Nader. And we get 8 years of the Bush administration, and we get things like the Patriot Act, and we get, the Great Recession, and just all kinds of terrible things come from that. And what it takes, usually, for the voting coalition on the left, the incredibly diverse, ideologically, culturally diverse voting coalition on the left, to vote in a unified way and pull in the same direction, is for that coalition to be able to recognize the clear and present existential threat that far-right authoritarianism actually presents. And once they can really see that, once they can see 4 years or 8 years of conservative rule, it's bad enough that people go, okay, all right, fine. I'll vote for anyone if it means that, you know, that we can get out of the situation that we're in now. And luckily in 2008, we had a candidate that was like pretty inspiring. It was a pretty inspiring option. Again, nowhere near a candidate that represents the values of the far left. Barack Obama is not a far left candidate. He is not a candidate that represents the political goals and values and ideals of the far left, but he's at least an inspiring candidate. He had aesthetic curb appeal to say, hey, this is a good way to rebuke far-right authoritarianism, is to elect the first black president in the history of the country. If I have to hold my nose and vote for somebody, this is a better option. This is a better situation than, you know, having to vote for just another old white guy. And at least we were able to get people unified on that. Cool. You get the Obama administration, and in the first 8 years, people on the left are pretty upset that the far left is upset that they're getting a lot of status quo stuff. They're not seeing enough change. This is the candidate that ran on a platform of hope and change, and they're not seeing it happen fast enough or drastically enough. And so what do? 2016, you literally let the first potential female presidential candidate lose to fucking Donald Trump, and we break up the voting coalition by voting third party and writing in Bernie Sanders and things like that. Look, I fucking love Bernie Sanders. I absolutely would have wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders in 2016 over Hillary Clinton. I still to this day believe that Bernie Sanders could have actually won. Unlike RFK or Jill Stein or Cornel West, I still to this day believe that Bernie Sanders had an actual legitimate mainstream shot at defeating Donald Trump in 2016. I'm really, really mad that the DNC shoved that other option down our throats, but it is the option they gave us, and I had to deal with the reality that we were being presented with and still say Hillary Clinton is a better option to be president than Donald Trump is. Unfortunately, the voting coalition on the left is so ideologically and culturally diverse, and the far left is so underserved, that we did what we do, and we broke up the coalition again, and we lost to fucking Donald Trump. And then you start the chain reaction of like, what is like the problem of letting far-right authoritarianism into the executive branch of power is they don't play fair. So they didn't allow Barack Obama to put Merrick Garland in the Supreme Court. They made up some rule about how you can't do that in an election year, and then they just let Donald Trump do the exact same thing that they said that you couldn't do, and Democrats weren't able to stop them. And listen, I understand that far-left voters are frustrated with the ineffectiveness of the Democratic Party when it comes to, like, fighting against the unfair tactics of the right. I totally understand, as a leftist myself, all of the reasons why voters on the left, on the far left, are frustrated with the DNC and frustrated with the sort of tepid political tactics and you know, status quo, you know, positions of the of the modern Democratic Party. I get it. Still, we've got to come together on a long-term strategy here. If you're going to look at me and say that I don't have the vision to see further than 4 years in the future, I'm going to every single time say, don't talk to me about that unless you can vote consistently, election after election, for at least 16 years. Because minimally, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take minimally two consecutive trips to the executive branch of power for one of these parties in order for the other one to no longer have viability in their current position. So, the problem with our current political Overton window is that this far-right extremist position is currently a politically viable position. There is no incentive for the Republican Party to shift tactics or to be any less extreme, to be any more moderate, to include any, you know, less extreme rhetoric in their political messaging. They are able to win elections like that. If you starve them out, if you take away the fuel that allows them to continue being viable, if you make it so that they can no longer win elections while being that far right and extremist, they will have to shift tactics. They will be forced to adjust. And what it will probably be early on, and this will not happen until there are at least two consecutive presidential terms with two different presidential candidates serving a full 8-year term. The cool thing about Kamala is we can kind of get a little like sneaky 12-year term in here. That's kind of fun. Like that's a cool thing where you can go 4 years of Biden, 8 years of Kamala, and you accomplish like a nice little 12-year block there, where you're going to get a good amount of starving done for the far right. But what will probably happen early on is that they will just soften some of their rhetoric. So they're not actually going to soften their agenda or soften their goals, but they will say, if we want to be viable with voters who exist sort of in this region of the political spectrum, if we want to be viable at all, we need to soften some of our rhetoric and stop being so Handmaid's Tale and dystopian, and at least make it seem like we're trying to be a little more moderate and we're trying to appeal to people closer to the center a little bit more. And then if you continue to starve them and say, no, that's not good enough either, we're going to continue voting consistently as a coalition, we're going to continue polling together in the same fervor, election cycle after election cycle, eventually, and this probably takes closer to like 24 years or even longer than that, like even up to 32 years, three straight decades of not letting them win elections while being this far right and extremist. That's how you slowly shift the political Overton window over to the left. And it takes time and it takes patience and it takes consistency. And it cannot happen without those things. It will never happen in a 4-year term. It will never happen in an 8-year term. As long as far-right authoritarian extremism knows that it can just wait 8 years to get in power again, nothing's going to shift. The only way to make the Republican Party shift over is to take away the viability of their position. If they can no longer win elections while being that far right, they will have no choice but to adjust their political strategy. And people on the far left keep going like, we need to incentivize the Democrats to change their position by not voting for them. And it's like, no, you need to incentivize the Republicans to shift. That's what shifts the Overton window over, because as the people on the far, the people who are actually weighting the Overton window down to the right, the people who are actually creating the situation where we are this far weighted to the right, we need to incentivize them to inch toward the center. Because once their messaging is more moderate and more centrist, it will make further left candidacy over in the Democratic Party more viable. It'll be like, oh, okay, cool. If we need to pose a stark contrast to a more centrist or more moderate Republican candidate, we can actually afford to be further left. So if you ever want to see mainstream political viability for the far left, you need to embrace some form of long-term consistent political strategy. It's a really, really, really hard sell because we have such an intellectually diverse coalition, and we have such a stubborn coalition. We have a coalition of voters who are just like, when they get an idea in their head about being right about something, they just will not let it go. But it's weird too, because then like all it takes is like 4 years of a Republican president or 8 years of a Republican president, and all of a sudden that coalition is super strong and super united. If that coalition can remain strong and remain united consistently, election cycle after election cycle, it will eventually shift the political Overton window and the political viability window over to the left. But it takes patience. And this is an option where you can do this without having to have a prolonged bloody civil war or a revolution. Like, you can do this. Like, you can actually have a prolonged peaceful revolution where you are going, the revolution is, we are just simply not going to allow Republicans to win elections anymore. Doesn't matter how much they gerrymander, doesn't matter how much they redistrict, we are simply going to deprive them of the fuel that they need to survive. And I don't know, like, I think it starts, we have a really great opportunity to start it in November to say, hey, we're gonna vote for a candidate that is in no way, shape, or form a far left candidate, but is a candidate who is electable. This is a inspiring candidate. This is a candidate that, you know, little girls across the entire world are going to look up to and say, that's possible for my future. That's inspiring. This is a, you know, a smart, intelligent, capable candidate. Is it a candidate that kind of toes the AIPAC line of status quo funding and geopolitical alliances? Yes, but you're not going to that drastically shift the political Overton window in just a matter of months in America. It's going to take a long-term strategy. Okay, let's see what people are saying. Justin Time says, we really need to try to push for a third party. Sometimes I have doubts of reframing the Democratic Party. Yeah, listen, I don't want to make it sound like I don't think a third party candidacy is ever viable in America. I think it's totally okay to continue pushing the idea of third party candidacy and of third party viability, but you've got to do it consistently. Again, the problem with political strategy on the left, as far as I can see, is there is no consistency. When there are people talking about third party candidacy, they can't agree on who the candidate should be. I mean, and these candidates are not similar to each other. Jill Stein is not similar to RFK. RFK is not similar to Cornel West. These people are not like bird, like you got to be able to decide who is this third party candidate, what party are they running for, and how can you make this party actually viable on the big stage? And of course that's got to happen at the local level. So I'm not saying don't ever advocate for third party candidacy or give up the dream of third party candidacy. I'm saying don't show up every 4 years and try to insert a third party candidate into the presidential election when you don't have a fucking prayer of making a dent in the kind of numbers that you need to be competitive in that race. Like, you can't show up every 4 years and pull 2 to 5 people away from the Democratic Party and think you're doing something. All you're doing is helping the conservatives to get back into power, and all you're doing is helping to fuel far-right authoritarian extremism for another term. And it's totally okay to say we should have more than two options. We are too big of a country and too intellectually and culturally diverse of a country to only be presented with two options every single year. That's totally fine. Figure out a way to organize at the local level to make these third party candidates viable there. Figure out a way to actually build their brand recognition and their brand awareness and their cultural viability to actually make sure that they can be a realistic option on the big stage. But you can't just show up every 4 years and go, what about this guy? And have most of the country go, who? who? Who's that? And you're like, no, this guy. Me and my friends have been talking about this guy. And we think he has a real shot. It's like, no, the fuck he does not. Get real. So, you know, Lady Gray says two shit ones at that. It usually is that. It usually is that for people on the far left. People on the right, they don't think it's two shit options. They're stoked about their option. They love going to the Republican National Convention and wearing a little piece of gauze on their right ear and being in a cult and wearing MAGA hats and just whatever Donald Trump says is good. Doesn't matter. That's totally cool by me. Totally awesome. They don't think it's two shit options. They think it's the coolest guy who ever lived and some liberal. That's what they think, but voters on the left who don't have any mainstream political representation always feel like we're given two shit options. Well, if you want better options on the left, you need to start embracing a long-term, consistent political strategy. You need to be willing to be patient. You need to be willing to slowly starve out far-right authoritarian extremism. And if you aren't willing to do that, if you aren't willing to engage with that process in a serious way, then I need to hear what your proposed plan actually is. Because so far what I hear from people like that is just like a whole bunch of fucking bitching. I just hear complaining. I just hear people who are just like mad. They're just mad that they don't like the options and they just want to burn the whole system to the ground. Cool, that's not a realistic plan, burning the whole system to the ground. Why are you so convinced that you're going to survive the fire that you start? Why are you so convinced that you're going to survive burning it all down to the ground? Or that whoever does survive burning it all down to the ground is going to rebuild the system in the way that you want them to? Why are you so convinced that whatever system gets rebuilt out of the ashes of the thing that you burned down is going to be better? Why are you so convinced that this is a better and safer option for marginalized and vulnerable communities? I just don't understand this strategy. I get your frustration. I get your anger. But you need to find a way to direct that anger in a more productive and realistic way. Justin Time says, I agree for the most part. Like you said, we can't be dividing what little left coalition we have. So you're wrong here, Justin. We don't have a little coalition on the left when we are unified. We have a massive coalition. We actually have the numbers to never lose another election again. That's kind of my whole point, is that the left is a more ideologically diverse coalition. It's also a much more populated coalition. There are just more people on the political left of the spectrum in America than there are on the right. We can absolutely win elections with the numbers that we have if we're able to get on the same page strategically. The problem is, it's not hard to spoil our coalition with a small group, a relatively small group of people in the coalition. So if 5 to 10 million people in the coalition want to do something like refuse to vote or vote third party or, write in a candidate or something like that, that's enough people in the right states. If they're in if they have the right numbers in battleground states, or if they, basically if they have the correct numbers in battleground states, that's enough people to spoil the outcome for everybody else. But it doesn't mean that our coalition is small. Our coalition is actually quite large and quite powerful when we're able to pull in the same direction. Paris says, Austin, no one says it's safer in the short to do the right thing for humanity in the long run. Correct. You and I agree. We're talking about long-term strategy here, right? So it's not necessarily safer for everyone. Or it's not like, humanity's going to be saved by electing Kamala Harris to the presidency in November instead of Donald Trump. It is safer. It's definitely safer. More people will be safe with her as president than as Donald Trump as president. The future will be in better hands with her as president than Donald Trump in president. It's marginal. It's marginally safer. It's not fixing the problem. So there are still going to be people who suffer. There are still going to be people who have to wait to get the utopia that they're holding out for. Israel is going to keep doing what Israel does. Our tax dollars are going to continue to do that. And that fucking sucks. But like, you don't have a realistic option that doesn't ally with Israel in November. You don't have a viable option that will shut down Israel. There is no option on the ballot that says stop the genocide in Gaza tomorrow. That's not a realistic option. So, hold on. I have to reset my live here on TikTok. So just like, you know, the trolley dilemma where it's like, I want the option where we turn the trolley into a rocket and we shoot when we fly over everybody. Cool. That option doesn't exist. So you need to deal with the options that you actually have on the table. When people say, if you vote for Kamala Harris, you're a genocide supporter. It's like, cool. If you help Donald Trump get elected, so are you. And those are your two options. One of those two people is going to be president after the election in November. It's going to be Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. That's the reality of the situation that you're in. And if you want to use that transitive property logic of like, if you vote for someone, then you are signing off on everything that they stand for and every ally that they have and every bit of tax money that they spend. Cool. If you voted for Joe Biden in 2020, then right now your tax money, your tax dollars, even if you didn't, your tax dollars are being spent the way that they're being spent. You don't get to write a letter to the government and say, stop spending my money that way. You can, but they're going to continue doing it the way that they're doing it. So when you say, you know, no one's saying that it's safer in the short to do the right thing for humanity in the long run. I'm with you on there. I'm not saying that in the short term, a vote for Kamala Harris is going to fix every problem with humanity that you have or every problem with the world on the geopolitical stage that you have. What I'm saying is, in the long run, there is a strategy here that can be better for people long term, that can be better for humanity long term. And if your comment here, Paris, by saying no one says it's safer in the short to do the right thing for humanity in the long run, if your comment is advocating for some kind of revolution, some kind of like violent conflict and saying, yeah, we're going to sacrifice safety in the short term to do the right thing in the long run. I just disagree with your strategy. That's the biggest problem I've been having all year long is that me and my fellow leftists simply strategically disagree. I disagree that like we need to sacrifice millions of lives to do the right thing for humanity in the long run. I think there's a way to do the right thing for humanity in the long run that is significantly more safe than what you're proposing. So I do think that it's possible to do the right thing for humanity in the long run without sacrificing nearly as many people as you seem to really like want to sacrifice. Lady Gray says, explain to the border why we should vote for Democrats who have almost the exact same policy goals as Republicans, but they just speak more politely. We've been living in a militarized surveillance state. We've been living for decades, but thanks for worrying. It may happen to folks living 100 miles inward. This whole thing of saying that the Democrats have almost the exact same political agenda as Republicans, I don't think you're aware of what the political agenda for Republicans is then, if you think that these two agendas are almost the exact same. There are a lot of things that are similar about our two main political parties in our political system because they accept funding in the same ways and they have to kind of use the same political tactics to both maintain their foothold where they have it in the same way. But it's just, I don't like... It's not like I don't think that you're like engaging with the political reality of our country if you think that they are basically indistinguishable from each other. I don't think that's a serious position. They're just not the same as each other. Like everybody that says this keeps citing. I can't tell you how many videos I've been tagged in of people who are talking about how under the Biden-Harris administration, Roe v. Wade was rolled back and the Chevron doctrine was rolled back. And I'm like, how do you not understand the difference between the executive branch of power and the judicial branch of power? And how do you not understand the domino hits that led to the judicial branch of power being what it is? Joe Biden did not appoint the current Supreme Court. That was done by Donald Trump. The reason why we have a conservative majority on the Supreme Court is because the left voting coalition was not able to vote in a consistent, unified way in 2016. They were able to show up in 2008 and in 2012, and they dropped the ball in 2016 and weren't able to keep moving in the same direction consistently. And immediately, we had massive repercussions at the level of the judiciary. And if you can't understand that very basic A plus B equals C, that like this is what happened, and because this happened, if you look at, I feel like it's so crazy to talk to people who they're just like, whoever's president at any given time, anything that happens while they're president is their fault. And it's like, that's not how our government operates. That is not like the executive branch of power does not have carte blanche authority over the judiciary branch of power. And of course they don't. Like, they are separate branches of power for a reason. Paris says, I don't see millions of people dying just by reforming the election process to allow for more than the two parties and media shove down our throats. Electable, but I get your point. No, totally. I'm with you on that. We can restructure our electoral system. You can't just advocate for it every 4 years, though, when your advocacy for that is going to allow far-right authoritarians to have to gain more power and to remain viable in America. You have to figure out how to strategize for a reform in the election process at the local level first. You have to make third-party candidacy viable at the local level first. You have to make ranked choice voting viable at the local level first. You can't just show up every 4 years and say, I'm mad that the current administration didn't accomplish my wish list, and then say, we should reform our political system. I agree we should have reforms. You need to build toward that incrementally. And again, this is long-term stuff that you need to be patient about, and you need to work on at the local community organizing level. So this person, I want to continue addressing this person who said, explain to us why we should, you know, vote for the Democratic Party. And I want to just say something here, which is, in November, there is going to be a certain faction of voters on the left in the left coalition who are just not going to vote for Kamala Harris. These are people who were never going to vote for Joe Biden, and they're not going to vote for her either. And we're just going to have to do this without them. And I'm accepting that like, I'm not going to spend the next 4 months trying to convince those people to change their minds. I think that those people, I hope that those people are about 2 to 5 million strong in their numbers. I understand why they're doing what they're doing. I get that they feel like they're doing what they have to do in order to stand strong for their values and their beliefs. I think that their vote is not realistic, and I think that it only serves to help far-right authoritarianism remain viable in America. But that's just us disagreeing on political strategy. But I do believe that there is also a faction of voters on the left, probably about 10 to 15 million people, who have been pretty apathetic about voting for Joe Biden, who have been really feeling like, God, I would just love any other option. I would feel so much better about getting excited about going to the polls in November if I could just have any other option. And I believe that we're going to have that faction of voters energized by this change. I think that what it was going to take to sort of be able to reclaim the ability to win in November was something historic, was something unprecedented. And I think this move from President Biden is pretty baller. And I think it's going to go down in history as like a really, really dope, baller, selfless move for the future of the country. And I think that we're going to see a lot of people who were unsure of like where they wanted to be a lot more activized and excited about this new option. I know I am. I'm one of those people who is just like, I couldn't really stomach even saying out loud that I was considering voting for Joe Biden. It was really, if you watch all of my videos where I've been talking about the election, in none of them do I say like, this is why we got to vote for Joe Biden. I can't even really say it out loud because I'm just like, I hate it. But I can say out loud that I will be voting for Kamala Harris in November. And I feel good about that vote. And I feel confident that I'm voting for a candidate who actually has the ability to win, and not just win, but like kind of mop the floor with this bullshit far-right authoritarian theocratic ideology. And that's what I want to see. That's what symbolically what I want to see moving into the next phase of American politics is I want a round, loud, enthusiastic rejection of everything that's happening at the RNC right now, of the literal idiocracy that is taking place with Hulk Hogan ripping his shirt off and being Nacho Supreme from a Mike Judge movie. I want a round, enthusiastic, loud rejection of that, even if it means that I'm voting for a candidate who is still not my dream leftist candidate. I'm probably not going to get that candidate for a while yet, but I'm excited to be able to vote for a candidate that I think is someone I can look at and say, I'm okay with that person being the spokesperson for my country for the next few years. I'm much more okay with that person having the job than with one of the worst humans that I've ever, like in the world having the job again. And I have a hard time, I got to say, understanding or, you know, sympathizing with voters on the far left who would rather let Donald Trump be president again than help elect the first woman president who's also a woman of color, who, like, they would rather watch Donald Trump be the spokesperson for the country for another 4 years and have, you know, Clarence Thomas and Alito retire so that he can put in even more conservative Supreme Court justices. They would rather see that happen because they actually want an accelerationist, you know, burn it all down strategy than to help with electing someone who is going to be a symbol of where we want to be directing our efforts, you know, going forward. And that's crazy to me to be a progressive person who wants to see this country progress and move in a certain orientation, and to be all in on a strategy that is going to, like, help Donald Trump win. And your reasoning for it's just so weird. It's like the reasoning is like, well, I can't support genocide. And it's like, well, first of all, you already do. Your tax dollars have already funded that, whether you wanted them to or not. Sorry. And that's the logic you're using, is just like anybody who, you know, doesn't align with your strategy as a genocide supporter. But like, okay, if that's the rule, then so are you. And second of all, like, you don't have an option on the ballot in November that will not be allied with Israel. So you're either going to help elect a woman of color to the White House for the first time in the history of this country, or you're either going to help elect Donald Trump. And that is what it is. Kay Leatherwood just said, it feels like they can afford that cost. I can't afford it. And, you know, I said that earlier, that I have people in my comments telling me the only reason you care about this is because now you stand to lose something as a white man. And I'm like, no, the exact opposite. The reason I care about this is because my most marginalized friends, who I've been fighting side by side with to gain, like, any amount of dignity and respect at the legislative level over the last, 20 years of my life, we've been fighting so hard to see things like marriage equality, fighting so hard to, even things as simple as, like, legalization of marijuana, and then under the Biden administration, like, pardoning of marijuana felonies and things like that, like, getting people who are who have been under the thumb of an oppressive government for the entire history of this country, finding them any corner of space where they can get a little more dignity and a little more recognition. I don't want to see them lose all of that overnight in one fell swoop just because of one election. And those are the people that I'm concerned about. Hayes 4049 just said, it's so exciting that Biden dropped and Trump is going down that I didn't even think about it being the first woman president. Yeah, I mean, like I posted something on Threads today about how, like, you know, whether you like her or not, she represents your values or not, she's a candidate who can win. And in a two-party electoral system that represents a country of 350 million people, that's what you need. You don't need a candidate who checks off your wish list. You need a candidate who can win, a candidate who can starve out far-right authoritarianism and extremism. And she is that candidate. And, somebody in my comments was like, you actually think she has a shot of winning? And I was like, have you been on the internet today at all? Have you been paying attention to the world for the last 8 hours since this news was announced? Like, everyone on the internet is talking about this right now, and talking about this with, like, an intensity and a fervor. Absolutely, she can win. Not only can she win, she can absolutely decimate this guy. And that's what I would like to see. Who should be her VP? Asks Just Saying. I don't know. Again, this is like wish list stuff. I like the idea of Buttigieg. I love that idea of a gay VP and a woman of color as the president. I love what that says as for the kind of the soul of the country, and like what that says symbolically about our values. And I just like, if you are a progressive voter who wants to live in a leftist utopia in a social with socialized healthcare and, you know, where we take down capitalism and we take down the billionaire class and those are where your values are aligned, I'm like, how can you say no to a woman of color in the White House with a gay VP? Like, how are you going to do that? And I know, I get it, that they're still aligned with a lot of establishment donors and things that you really, really have big moral and ethical quandaries with. But, like, how are you going to let them lose to a guy like Donald Trump and still call yourself, a progressive? Let's see. Christian says, Trump has been beating Harris in a few polls, but I think it's because people don't know her yet. I mean, yeah, it's day one. I think, give it a second. I think that this is a much more viable option for the voting coalition on the left than Biden was. We just got a comment from Control Alt. Genuine question. I've heard people talk about third-party candidates, and I don't understand what people mean when they say it's a two-party system. There is more options, but nobody talks about them. Okay, so you must just be showing up to the conversation. I've been talking about this the entire conversation. It is a two-party system because those are the two parties that are actually electable and viable every 4 years in the presidential elections. We have the option in our democracy to make third-party candidacy viable. So there are people who are technically running for president, and I'm putting this in quotes for anyone listening on Spotify. They are technically running for president this year. They're not viable candidates. They're not going to win. The reason why nobody talks about them is because they're not serious options. They're not worth talking about. You need so much more brand recognition and actual institutional power before you can be an actual viable option for the presidency in America. As it stands in November, it's going to be a Democrat or a Republican because those are the establishment powers with the requisite brand awareness and recognition and like institutional power to actually be viable in a presidential election. A third party candidate has the ability to win at the local level, and third party candidates have won at the local level, and even like at the congressional level and the senatorial level. You can make third party candidacy viable in this country. You need to start smaller. You can't just show up every 4 years and say, how about a third party candidate for president? And if you're gonna do it, you got to figure out how to make that person have a real moment. And so I made a video about this recently where I said 80 million people, minimally 80 million people. You need a coalition of 80 million people who are aware of who your candidate is, aware that your candidate is running for president, and actually seriously considering advocating for and voting for your candidate. And if all you've got is like 2 to 5 million people with 4 months left in the election, then there's no reason anyone should be talking about your candidate or taking your candidate seriously. The only purpose they serve at that point is to disrupt and siphon votes away from one of the two candidates who is going to win, which is at this point is Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. It's just math. It's not about what I like or what I believe in or what I want. It's just math. People talk about like, well, France did it in 4 weeks. France is a country of 68 million people. They have about 49 million registered voters, and about 65% of those registered voters actually showed up to vote in their election. So they needed to convince like 10 million people to push for a radical change. You need to convince, as a third party voter, you need to convince like 75 million people to see things your way in a coalition that is massively ideologically and culturally diverse and, you know, famously hard to please. It's amazing that the Democratic Party has been able to win elections with a voting coalition as ideologically and culturally diverse as, you know, the political left in America. Until you can actually show that level of competitiveness and viability, that's why it's going to remain two parties. Lady Gray says, funny how coalition building seems to prioritize right-leaning folks. Again, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here and say that you're just showing up to the conversation. The reason why it prioritizes right-leaning folks is because the political Overton window in America is heavily weighted to the right. The reason why the political Overton window is heavily weighted to the right is because the far right is the only political position that actually has mainstream political representation and power in America when it comes to, extremist positions. The far left has no mainstream political power or representation, so the entire political viability and Overton window is heavily weighted to the right. So coalition building, when you're building a coalition of voters on the right, the candidates that they're going to get are going to skew to the right, not to the left, because the entire viability window in America skews to the right. And that's not because of political strategists like me. That's not because of like leftists who aren't like doing enough to, stymie the Democratic Party. That's because the voting coalition on the left, which is incredibly ideologically diverse, has a hard time being consistent election after election. And we keep letting far-right extremists win elections. As long as we keep doing that, far-right authoritarian extremism will remain a viable political position in America. As long as that is a viable political position in America, we will not be able to shift the Overton window to the left. The only way to build a coalition that actually prioritizes the values of people on the left is to do it slowly with a slow, patient, consistent political strategy. You have to starve far-right authoritarian extremism. You have to make it so that they can no longer win elections while being that extreme. The only way you can do that is to vote against them election after election after election. What that's going to mean for the first 16 to 20 years is voting for candidates who are centrist or just like center left and slowly maybe a little bit more left, but you're not going to get a far left viable candidate for the presidency until you've sufficiently starved far-right authoritarianism, until you've actually made it so that the Republican Party realizes they can no longer win elections that way. Ted K says, yap, yap, yap. I always love that response. It's just like, oh, you're saying a bunch of stuff that I don't have a response to, so yap, yap, yap. I love that. Like, you're saying a bunch of stuff that makes sense, yap, yap, yap. I don't like it. Those are the people, Ted K, those are the people that, like, we're just not going to convince, and I'm not going to spend my time convincing them. We're going to have to win this election without the Ted Ks of the world. Ted K doesn't actually have a way of shifting the political Overton window over to the left, doesn't actually have a realistic strategy for it, just sees me talking about it and goes, yap, yap, yap. Really, really smart political strategy there, Ted K. Definitely more eloquent than anything I could have come up with. Gwen says, exactly, the fact that the right has taken over the way they have today is because they started the work in the 80s. They were methodical and they began at the local level and worked their way up. And Gwen is spot on. The voting coalition on the right has been consistent about their political strategy for over 40 years now. And that is why they have such institutional power with such extreme positions. Now, the reason why it's easier for the right to be consistent long-term is because they are a less ideologically and culturally diverse coalition. Are you listening, Ted K? Are you listening to this? Because I'm actually saying stuff that makes sense here if you're willing to actually open your brain instead of just going yap, yap, yap. The reason why the political right has been able to strategize long-term and be consistent is because they are a much easier voting base to appeal to. They are much more homogenous. They are much more homogenized. They're far less diverse. It's hard to get voters on the left to pull in the same direction consistently because people on the far left never get candidates that actually inspire them, and also because we're all so goddamn different. We all have such different ideas about strategy. But the only way that we're ever going to accomplish anything together is if we can just pick a plan and all do that thing. Now, the reason why I favor the strategy of voting consistently over a long period of time is, again, the numbers. The numbers just favor my strategy. There are just way more people in this massively diverse coalition of voters on the left. There are way more people who consistently show up and vote Democrat every single election cycle than there are people who are trying to disrupt and advocate for third-party voting, ranked choice voting, whatever it is, political revolution, you know, mayhem and chaos in the streets. The numbers just favor the fact that it's like, okay, I'd rather have to convince, you know, 5 million people to get on board with this plan than convince 80 million people who the vast majority of them are not that politically active anyway. The reality of most voters, the overwhelming majority of voters, whether they're on the right or the left of the political spectrum in America, is that for the vast majority of these people, they all vote the same way in every single election. They vote for the same people every single time, and they will for their entire lives. Most people are just not that informed. And so when you're picking a strategy of like, what is a viable strategy that can work for a coalition of 100 million people, 120 million people that are all very culturally and ideologically diverse, you got to go with the numbers. Like, which strategy has the numbers? Which strategy has the ability to actually be accomplished? And time and time again, the strategy of just pulling in the same direction of voting against, not necessarily voting for the Democrats, but voting against far-right extremism, when we can do that, we actually can win. And we've shown time and time again that that is a viable, realistic strategy. The only thing that we're missing is consistency with that strategy. The right have been pretty consistent. They don't have the numbers, but they have the consistency. They all show up every single time. And when we drop the ball and we can't be consistent on a 4 to 8 year cycle, they get to get back in, and far right extremism gets a little more time and gets a little more fuel and gets to survive a little longer. Kind of Baboon says, how much of a chance do you think we have? I think we have a much better chance today than we did yesterday. With the announcement of President Biden stepping down and endorsing Kamala Harris, I think we have a much, much, much better chance of winning the election in November than we did yesterday. Yeah, again, somebody in my comments was like, do you actually think she's got a realistic chance? And I was like, yeah, more than any other person alive today who's not Donald Trump. There just simply is not another, like, people who are like, well, the DNC hasn't given her the nomination yet. It's like, give me a fucking break. Like, there is no one alive right now who has a better shot of beating Donald Trump in November than Kamala Harris. And anybody who is actually politically aware and being serious about the political reality in America knows that. It's not even something you need to, like, you don't even need to know a lot about politics to understand this. Like, you can just look at the internet today. Have you ever seen a day in the last year where the internet was talking this much about Jill Stein? Have you ever seen a single day where the internet was even talking close to this much about RFK? Even when news came out about his brain worm, the internet wasn't talking about him as much as they're talking about Kamala Harris today. You know, have you seen anybody talking with even close to amount to this amount of fervor and excitement and passion and enthusiasm on any single day about Cornel West? Be serious. No, you haven't. JG Dangerfield says, Hillary won the popular vote. Right you are. That's, you know, I don't know what point you think you're making there. I think you're making my point there, which is like, the left has the numbers to win elections. The Republican Party has not won a popular vote in decades. The reason why they're able to stay viable is because the left cannot stay consistent in key battleground states where they need to stay consistent. Our coalition gets broken up too easily. We are too easily dismayed and swayed away from our long-term political strategy. So we have the numbers to win the popular vote every single cycle. And when we actually pull in the same direction with the numbers that we really need, we have the numbers to never lose another election again. But like saying Hillary won, JG Dangerfield says she won the popular vote, but still didn't win the White House. I'm aware. You know that there's two different things you need to win, right? You need to win the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. You actually just need to win the electoral vote. That's the only, you don't actually even need to win the popular vote. But like, when the coalition of voters on the left actually show up and pull in the same direction consistently, we win the electoral vote. And then he says, you've got passion and fervor, brother, but that's about it. Love ya. Yeah, I don't think you actually know what the fuck you're talking about, to be honest. You have no clue what you're talking about. You're just like, she won the popular vote, but she didn't win the White House. It's like, oh, yeah, do you understand how the American political system works? The electoral system? Like, yeah. Yeah. My God, the way you win the Electoral College is by having everybody, you know, like we need, you know, about 85% of the voting coalition on the left to pull for a candidate in order to win the electoral and the popular vote. Hillary probably got about 78%. She didn't get quite what she needed. She had enough to beat Donald Trump in the popular vote, but she didn't have the right votes in key battleground states. And that's, you know, what presidential campaigns come down to too often. We also need to talk about reforming the Electoral College and breaking that up and getting rid of that archaic system, obviously. But that's not going to happen before November. So the best option for Kamala Harris is for us to inspire the most possible voters on the left to pull for her in November. She's going to get the lion's share of votes, of voters on the left. It's not going to be Jill Stein. It's not going to be Cornel West. It's not going to be RFK. She's going to get 10 times the amount of votes of any one of those people easily. So she could lose, you know, she could get 75 million votes and lose by a couple million or lose by a couple electoral votes. But she's got the best chance of anybody in the race right now. And if you don't understand that, then you're not engaging realistically with what's going to the situation that we have. Capitalism hater says it would be cool if the candidate represented the voters. I've just got to assume that everyone's just showing up midway through this conversation. That's what's happening, right? I've been talking for an hour and a half about this, capitalism hater. You must have just shown up. Like, the entire conversation has been about that. Has been about how do you get candidates who represent voters on the far left? How do we get that to happen? That's not a thing that actually exists in America at the moment. Like, far left, leftism, socialism does not have actual mainstream political representation and power in America. So the whole entire conversation of this podcast has been, how do we do that? How do we create a situation where there will be viable candidates who actually represent, far left ideology and even more progressive ideology? Also, this conversation has been about how the voting coalition on the left is incredibly ideologically diverse. So when you say it would be cool if the candidate represented the voters, I hope you understand you're talking about like 100 million people. You're talking about finding a candidate who represents 100 million people. Now, doing that on the right isn't a big deal. It's pretty easy to find a candidate that 100 million white Christian bigots can get behind. That's not too hard. Finding a candidate that, like, that, you know, 80 to 90 million dyed-in-the-wool white supremacist Christians who just want to live in an authoritarian theocracy can get behind, that's pretty easy. But finding a candidate that accurately represents a coalition of like 100 million people who are as intellectually and ideologically diverse as the left is very difficult. It's really hard. That's why it's so impressive that the Democratic Party has been able to maintain the foothold that they have, even. But, Control Alt says, what is your opinion on abolishing the Electoral College? I'd love to see it happen. Again, these are things that need to start taking place at the local level, at the local community organizing level. Abolishing the Electoral College is a pretty progressive idea at the legislative level. It's a pretty big swing to think that somebody like Kamala Harris would abolish the Electoral College in her first term or even her second term. A goal like that probably would not get accomplished in the next 8 years, regardless of who wins. It's definitely not going to get accomplished if Donald Trump wins, but it probably won't get accomplished within the 8 year span of a full length Harris presidential term. But what can happen is that as you slowly shift the political Overton window over by consistently voting out far-right authoritarianism and extremism, as you consistently deprive far-right candidates and far-right positions of their power, you do make further, you know, more progressive ideas and more progressive positions more viable, more appealing. You start to create an environment in which there can be candidates who are actually viable, who will have ideas like abolishing the Electoral College on their agenda, and they will be actually viable candidates. I know that candidates crop up every 4 years who talk about things like universal basic income or abolishing the Electoral College or ranked choice voting. I know that these people exist. What I'm talking about is viability, is actual big level brand awareness and recognition and real institutional power behind these ideas. That's probably not going to happen in a four-year term. But it is a goal that you can work toward incrementally by being patient and consistent. Somebody just asked, do you think she is strong enough to go against Trump? Fucking easily. It's like the energetic difference between Kamala Harris as a presidential candidate and Joe Biden as a presidential candidate is astronomical. There is such a massive difference in charisma, in optics, in like just like absolutely. She can absolutely decimate and humiliate this guy and mop the floor with him. So JG Dangerfield said, never said to give up. Until you're ready to go for what you believe in, then you're not going to change anything. I'm ready. So am I. And that's what I'm talking about in this entire conversation. I'm talking about a strategy to go for what I believe in. And my strategy is a long-term strategy that requires patience and consistency. I don't know what strategy you're talking about. I think you can just sort of jump in every 4 years and take a sledgehammer to the entire system and break it down and go for it. And it'll just happen on sheer will. And I don't think that that's a realistic strategy. Oh, okay. Great. Aaron Bushnell, JG Dangerfield just said Aaron Bushnell and I would disagree. Cool. So yeah, I have a whole video essay about Aaron Bushnell and about the idea of like all or nothing political advocacy and political strategy and why it doesn't work and why it's not realistic. Like that whole thing, if you're saying that like the only viable strategy is to self-immolate and kill yourself for the things that you believe in, and that if you're not willing to do that, then you're not a serious political advocate or you don't have a serious political strategy. You said, don't strawman me. You're the one who said Aaron Bushnell, man. So then you go, don't strawman me. Thanks. Then don't say Aaron Bushnell. If you're not doing what Aaron Bushnell did, then you're not Aaron Bushnell, my guy. Sorry to tell you. And also, guess what? Aaron Bushnell didn't fucking stop the genocide in Gaza. I'm so sorry to tell you that. I'm so sorry to like break your brain here, but Aaron Bushnell did not fucking change what's happening in Gaza. Okay? So You can say Aaron Bushnell's name all you want, but like either like get on his level or get his fucking name out of your mouth. All right. Yeah, this whole idea of like all or nothing. That's all. That's all, my guy. You want to be all in? That's all. He gave all of his money and he gave every possible ounce of his physical being that he could to the cause. If you're not doing that, if you're saving some money for yourself and if you're saving some energy for the people in your life, for your family members, for your friends, then you're not Aaron Bushnell, my guy. God. Oh, jeez. I feel like I'm talking to toddlers. Somebody just says abolishing the Electoral College would require a constitutional amendment. Yes, it would. And again, it's a pretty progressive idea to put forward. It's doable. It's an accomplishable goal. And what it would take is for voters in the left voting coalition to show consistently, election cycle after election cycle, that this is the direction we want the political Overton window to move. We need to show consistently that we want politics in America to move further to the left. And the way you do that is by making far-right extremism a dead position in America. You just make it so that that is no longer a position that can win elections. And what you show energetically and symbolically is we are no longer voting for anything that's even close to, we just are going to keep pushing things this way. But it happens by inches. It has to happen just gradually and over time, but you have to be consistent. If you push an inch to the left and then get frustrated that things aren't going far enough to the left and let things slip back to the right, you got to start over again. All right, let's do one more comment. Let's wrap this up. Let's see if we can wrap this up. The right is working strategically to move us backward. We have to be willing to be strategic too. Exactly. The right has had a long-term political strategy that has been working for them for over 40 years now. And again, the reason why they are able to pull consistently in the same direction as a coalition is because they are a less diverse coalition of voters than the coalition of voters on the left. However, the coalition of voters on the left are more powerful. We we have the numbers, we actually have the cultural influence and the weight to actually shift the Overton window to the left, it's going to take a consistent concerted effort from all of us. Cycle in and cycle out. This is not just about vote blue no matter who. I hate that slogan. I think it's so reductionist and it makes people think that all you're saying is it doesn't matter who the candidate is, just vote for a Democrat. That is such a, it's not a, that saying that makes people think that you're just telling them to be a robot. And what we actually need to be advocating for is that, like, the goal is to starve out and kill far-right extremism as a mainstream political position in America. The only way to shift politics to the left is to do that. If you can do that, if you can make it so that the Republican Party cannot win elections while being this extreme, while being this bigoted, while being this theocratic, while being this fascistic, if you can do that, if you can make it so that they no longer have actual political weight and power, you can start to shift things to the left incrementally. All right, everybody. Thank you for a lively, spirited discussion today. Lots going on. Thanks for hanging out. Thank you for your comments. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. There's theme music on the audio version, if you don't know, over on Spotify. It's pretty fun. You can get more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or by looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music, wherever you stream music. I got tunes there. You can get my double vinyl on my Bandcamp. Check it out. Patreon.com/Austin Archer if you want to support what I do here on this show. Shout out to the Patreon patrons. Y'all rule. I love my Patreon patrons. Incredible people. Incredibly generous people. Appreciate you and your contributions to helping me continue the things that I do. Let's go. Harris 2024. Harris and whoever. I don't know. But I think we got a candidate here. I think we actually got a race here. I think we got somebody who can enthusiastically shout down the absurdity of Trumpism and far-right extremism. Let's do it. Let's not fumble this bag. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love y'all. Bye-bye.